Welcome to Happy Hour with Julie and Liz.
So, Liz.
Yes.
It appears that our devoted fans are getting a little bit restless and impatient.
We've been missing in action.
M.I.A. Well, we did have two good excuses. One being your visit down here to Florida to stay with me for a few nights and attend the Real Clear Politics Gala, honoring Miranda Devine and Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and Matt Taibbi for their courageous reporting, which well deserved. So, Liz, why don't we tell our listeners a little bit about our visit?
I don't know. So I went down to Florida and I got to stay with Julie. I could have stayed at a hotel, but obviously I want to spend good time with Julie. So if you felt like a disturbance in the fort, that's why. We were together for 3 days, or basically like 2 days. And I got to stay at her beautiful house. She took really good care of me. And we didn't tape the podcast because we went to Nordstrom's.
Yes, we did.
We went to Nordstrom's.
We went to Nordstrom's. We went to Macy's. We went to Saks.
People about Macy's.
Then we had a lovely lunch at Chick-fil-A, because of course that's what you do in a beautiful sunny day here in Southern Florida. Because Liz was not satisfied with her outfit for the gala.
It's true.
She did find a great dress, though. You found a great dress. It was the shoes. The shoe issue was the problem.
We had a shoe issue. But if there's any place Julie and I are most comfortable, it is a mall. As Gen Xers, as 80s kids.
Okay, there you go. Good way to bring it back to the 80s. Although, Liz, let's talk about that mall and what you said about the mall in West Palm Beach.
It was very disappointing. I mean, the mall experience is totally different now. And I think it's very sad because it was so important as teenagers that the mall was where everybody was. We were all at the mall. People worked at the mall. Your friends worked at the mall, right? You had a friend, they worked at Hot Dog on a Stick or Orange Julius or maybe Contempo, which would be even better. But, you know, everybody was at the mall. It was the place to be seen. Every weekend, our parents would just dump us off. There were no phones. They had no idea if we even stayed at the mall. And maybe we didn't sometimes. I don't know. And it was such an important social part of our social experience. And the stores were great. The malls now are horrible.
Well, this is more of a, to be fair, it's not like your typical suburban mall. It's got like Gucci and Louis and Chanel. You know, we didn't have that.
No.
You know, the most upscale store was like Marshall Field's. Well, of course, being from Chicago. But no, this comment about how comfortable you felt at the mall at West Palm Beach, what you said about being around your people.
Oh, yeah. So I'm not going to say that because I'm not going to repeat what I said because I'm going to get another watch list.
Oh, no, you're not. It's hilarious.
I don't want to get on another watch list, so I'm not going to repeat it.
It was not anything racial, or it was not disparaging. It was just like, hey, I feel comfortable.
Everybody was Jewish.
Here with my people.
So I was like, wow, everybody's Jewish here. That's all. I'm Jewish. So I'm allowed to say that.
Exactly. That's why I had you say it and not me. Because
don't put me on a watch list.
Would be targeted as an anti-Semite. But Liz, I do want to share one thing with our listeners, which really concerns me, because I think that people who have the sleeping habit are serial killers.
Okay.
And that is the fact that you told me that you sleep with one pillow.
I do.
Did you spend time in prison? Is that
no.
where that came from?
I do. I just sleep with one pillow.
I don't understand how this is possible.
Where are the other pillows, Julie? What do you do with the other pillow? Like, you have one pillow for your head, and then what? Where are the other pillows?
Well, I have two pillows for underneath my head. Then I have a body pillow because I hate when my knees touch when I'm sleeping because my knees are kind of bony because my legs are skinny. So I have like, I don't like that touching feeling. And then I usually put another pillow over my head. So I kind of prefer like a coffin like environment when I sleep, which is one of my friends calls it. Like I could sleep in a coffin as long as it had like 10 pillows. But I just, I'm confused. So our listeners can share their pillow
preferences.
But I think if I had one pillow, I would try to cut it up into at least a few. I don't know. That was interesting. It's interesting to me.
I don't think it's good to sleep with your neck elevated from the rest of your spine. It's supposed to be like, it's supposed to be straight. So if you have two pillows under your neck, you're elevating your neck.
Oh, that must be why I have scoliosis.
Or something or other. I'm just saying. So I just have a pillow under my head, and then I like to be, I keep my room very cold, and then I have like a down, then I stay very warm inside, like a little nest.
Are you a side or you are you?
I'm a side sleeper. I am a side sleeper.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's my sleep hygiene. And, you know, sometimes I wear a mask like to shut the light out just because I do have, I have sleeping problems. I have a sleep disorder. That's why people are like, why are you up at 3 a.m.? Oh, because I have a sleep disorder, which I do. So I do sometimes have a mask. But basically, I am a one pillow girl. And I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to apologize for that.
Oh, no. It's just, you know, I think something people should know. That's all.
People should know about your entire regime that you have.
It's very involved.
You have quite a complicated situation. So
when I stay at people's houses, I'm like, where's the rest of the pillows? They're like, there's four on the bed. I'm like, well, I understand, but you know, there's two of us
or something.
Yeah. Not right. Anyway. So that's that, but we had a great time. A lot of laughs and the gala was very well done. So
we saw great people. We saw our friends like Ben Weingarten and Dave Reboy, and we met lots of people, actually.
It was great to meet Miranda Devine. She's so lovely in person.
Yes, she's and so was Jay Bhattacharya. Yes. Super nice.
Yeah.
It was a great event. So I'm glad I went, and I don't usually do social things because I'm antisocial.
Hermit. Well, I kind of made you. I kind of shamed you into coming, I feel
she
like.
She did. She did. But it was a great time. It was always good to see Julie. But we did not tape a podcast because we went to Nordstrom's. And that's on me. I'll own it.
Please do.
Okay.
And then last week I didn't because I was at the hearing here in Florida, Thursday hearing for Donald Trump classified documents. We could talk about that later, but it's been an active week in Washington this week, and I believe last week too, but I think the highlight I would have to say was Wednesday testimony of Tony Bobulinski, the former Biden family business partner, who testified. Well, what was the committee? Was it House?
I think it was Oversight. It was Oversight.
So Tony Bobulinski is sort of, in a way, I mean, he's very courageous, right? Because he was kind of blowing the whistle on the Biden family crime racket right before the election. I think Tucker interviewed him. He showed up at one of the debates, and he was just confirming and has details about their business dealings with Chinese.
Well, we have the emails, and not just the emails from Hunter's laptop. Tony Bobulinski has produced his emails as well that are also on Hunter Biden's laptop. So there are people that say, oh, the laptop's not real. Remember, because we had 51 of our best and brightest intelligence officials tell us that it was Russian disinformation. But Tony Bobulinski, and that was going to fly. I mean, that was going to fly. That was going to be the story. And Tony Bobulinski came out and he's like, here are my own personal copies of those emails as well. Because when you send an email, you have a copy in your saved folder, and the person who receives it also has a copy. And he's very brave for coming out and doing that and producing it. That kind of stopped, or it didn't stop, but it kind of helped slow down the momentum of this. 51 intelligence officials, most who had never seen the laptop, if not all, did not see the laptop, examine it, look at it, because I don't even think the FBI did, or they claim not to, to ensure its veracity. But Tony Bobulinski came out and he really stopped that, or put the brakes on that narrative, which was going to be the story to defuse the laptop from hell. So anyway, yesterday he testified before the Oversight Committee, and there was some fireworks. And I like that he went there like aggressive, because these people, the Democrats, the AOCs, the Goldmans, these clowns, they need to be treated for what they are, you know, and not this sort of respectful, you know, protocol. They need to be treated derisively, because that's what they deserve, because they're clowns. So his opening comments were quite fire, where he called out Goldman and Raskin, talking about what liars they were and how they were just going to go up to the media and lie. It was gutsy. What'd you think, Julie? Give us more.
I thought it was hilarious. And I mean, I give him credit, because first of all, it's a very courageous thing to do, because we know what this regime, the federal government and DOJ, all of these agencies are willing to do to go after and pursue the enemies of Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. So this takes balls, right?
Yeah.
And he did not mince words. Now, you know, we are like the most basic podcast that you will find. So we don't have a way of like channeling this into our Skype recording, but I'm just going to play it off of Twitter, because it was hilarious. So this is Tony Bobulinski facing the degenerate lowlife liars, Jamie Raskin, and I believe Dan Goldman. So this is the beginning of the hearing. Can I play this? Because it's hilarious. And you'll hear James Comer as well, who has the Southern accent. He's from Kentucky. And then, of course, you'll identify the voice of little weasel man, Jamie Raskin. All right, hold on one second. 11 apply
to that. The same people preaching this mantra know better. They continue to lie directly to the American people.
That's
without
Bobulinski.
Hesitation and remorse. Rep. Dan Goldman and Jamie Raskin, both lawyers, and Mr. Goldman, a former prosecutor with the SDNY from New York, will continue to lie today in this hearing and then go straight to the media to tell more lies. Hunter Biden's defense attorney, Abby Lowell, weaponizes letters to Congress to try to smear my name.
Mr. Chairman.
The cold hard facts.
Mr. Chairman.
In an attempt to save his powerfully connected client and his father. I challenge Mr. Lowell to make those claims on national television so he can be held accountable for his lies. Prior to my successful business career, I was an officer in the United States Navy. At Navy's elite Naval Nuclear Power Training Command, I later served as the command's chief technology officer.
I apologize for the disruption.
That's Comer.
Am I supposed to say it's my time, Mr. Raskin? Yeah. Please.
Okay. Go to order. Mr. Bobulinski, please proceed. Okay. Please proceed. I apologize for the disruption from the minority.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if it saved his
Jamie
time,
Raskin.
He called members of this committee liars, and I just want to know whether the order and decorum requirements of House Rule 11 apply to witnesses appearing before the committee. Does it apply or does it not?
Should I address? I don't.
So they're looking now at the rules.
There's decorum for the members. We've asked for that. There's no language that I'm aware of pertaining to a witness.
Love it.
Waste any of his time on the opening statement. Mr. Bobulinski, I'm sorry for the disruption. Please continue your opening statement.
I think Mr. Raskin, used.
We'll make sure it's right.
Great. I just want to restate, make sure the American people hear all these facts.
I love that. That was so great.
So here's Jamie Raskin, who has lied so lies much. Every single day, right? So he led the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump for January 6th. Then he was on the January 6th Select Committee, which we now know concealed, destroyed evidence, refused to turn over, as they're supposed to, records and evidence collected by the committee investigators to House Republicans. And here he is, like, crying to the congressional teacher. He's being mean. He's calling us liars. That was pretty gutsy.
I'm not surprised. I mean, these people are cowards. They just have the protection of the intelligence community and the security state. You know, that's why they have the assistance of the media to amplify their lies and pretend that it's factual. So, but when the playing field is an even keel, they lose, right? Or they have to go to mommy and their wet nurse to wipe their butt, which is what Jamie Raskin did. So good on Bob Alinsky for doing that and for really treating these people the way they deserve, which is, like I said, with derision, mockery, and scorn.
Well, and then there was another highlight of AOC.
Yeah.
Trying to challenge, and Bob Alinsky was having none of it. I mean, by any of, and you had AOC, you had that wretched, what's her name, Crockett. I think she's like from the Virgin Islands or some,
yeah,
some pretend representative. And he was having none of it. Like, he didn't care if it was a black woman or AOC or Jamie Raskin. He was loaded for bear. So she's pushing him to name the crimes that the Bidens are guilty of. You know, and of course, she's nagging him. What crimes? Won't let him answer. So finally, he says, well, RICO. And this is, of course, the same charge that Fannie Willis has brought against Donald Trump and two dozen, the state's version anyway, in Georgia. And she says, RICO is not a crime. And I mean, the whole room starts laughing. So it was just a farce.
She's a bartender. I mean, nothing against bartenders, but like.
Right.
She's not a lawyer. Now, I'm not saying that any of the other lawyers that are Democrats wouldn't try and finagle something similar, but RICO is, in fact, racketeering is a crime. It's laughable that she would say that, and or maybe she really doesn't know. I guess she really doesn't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think. What did she say? She's like, that's not a crime. It's a. Oh, I have the clip.
She's a category of crime. No, it's literally right, people are charged under a RICO statute under the racketeering statute. It is a crime.
And there were some people on Twitter who were Italian. They're like, oh, my God, my Italian relatives will be so happy to hear RICO is not a crime.
I mean, that's what they went after the mafia for, or they tried, is to get them under racketeering charges. So it's laughable. But I think these people in the hearings – you know, it's great that we have hearings, but, you know, what are the consequences of the hearing? Like I always say, and, you know, the Democrats go there with a view to getting their soundbite on MSNBC or CNN. And that's kind of what AOC was trying to do, or on Instagram in her case, or whatever social media she uses. And these people try and go in and get their zingers, and they don't really think it through, knowing that they'll go to a friendly outlet and the outlet isn't going to question them on what they say. They'll just go, oh, of course, no, RICO's not a crime. Although, in, you know, 20 minutes earlier, they're talking about RICO charges against the Trump people.
Right. For talking about election fraud.
Yeah, like, exactly. So it's laughable.
So, but there were some other hearings this week I wish we could have gotten to. Apparently, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the evil Tretorius, Mark Milley, testified about the Afghanistan withdrawal. So hoping we can get some coverage on that. I wasn't able to watch it, but there's, there was a lot of different hearings going on, but, so there's that. We could talk about the classified documents case in a little bit, but it looks like New York Attorney General Letitia James is getting ready to start seizing Donald Trump's property because he has not paid his fine.
$500 billion fine.
Gazillion, or, I don't know. Trillion, something like that. $454 million judgment in a civil fraud case, which of course was a fraud itself. The case, the prosecutor, the judge that clown Arthur Engoron. So, and he's also, this judge, Arthur Engoron, has also refused to delay President Trump, former President Trump, paying the sum or posting a bond. Now, he also cannot find any company to underwrite a bond for him. It looks like he has been rejected, reports are, from 30 companies, inching him closer to the possibility of having his property seized. This is reporting from Reuters. They have approached Trump and his two children, have approached these companies through four separate brokers. I hope if Trump wins, he remembers who these companies are, right?
Maybe it's time for some, you know, government scrutiny. Yeah.
Maybe he could do that. So anyway, I guess he's got to pay this by Monday, or Letitia James, another moron, just like we just heard from AOC, will start, I guess, seizing his property.
I wonder if these people really think that this is hurting Trump, because I see this as only helping Trump. The more we see these meltdowns and the more extreme actions that we see from them in their Trump derangement syndrome, the more apparent it is that they're just batshit insane.
Yeah.
And the more people who can see that what's happening, because not everybody's like us, we're based, right? Our listeners are based. But there are about 20% of the population that are not super politically engaged, even though that's getting very hard to do these days. The more extreme these people get, the better likelihood that those people are going to finally, it's going to click about what's going on, about how ridiculous this is and how the rules don't apply to Donald Trump. And that's what they say. They say, oh, well, Donald Trump thinks he's outside the rules. But the fact is, they think that the rules don't apply to Donald Trump, which is that he doesn't get the same consideration, the same treatment. He has charges brought against him that would never be brought against someone else. And now all of a sudden he can't get a bond, right? Or, you know, any of the mundane things that have been criminalized by the state of New York and by Letitia James, who's like a glory hound. But do they think that this hurts him? Because I don't think it hurts him. What about you, Julie? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't think they think politically if it hurts him, because they are so bloodthirsty about their bloodlust for Donald Trump and his family members. It is insatiable. So they don't really care what the consequences are. They don't care if politically they think that it hurts him. You have Letitia James with all these, you know, Democrats, limousine liberals in Washington, New York, telling her, this is great. This is great. Bankrupt him. Start stealing his property. Destroy him and his family. Completely bankrupt them. So she doesn't care. So she doesn't even care about the consequences for her own political career.
I guess. All I see is that this makes everything Trump has said in the past true, which is that there's some sort of government or the state is going after him, you know, in his battles against the deep state, when everybody made fun of that and said, oh, there's no such thing as a deep state. Then they started calling it the deep state. They gave in and admitted there's something called the deep state, or this sort of institutional bureaucracy that sustains through administration and changes and party changes and so on. So all this does is validate what Trump has said about these people in power who have it out for him because he is not on board and not playing their reindeer games. So my hope is that they'll continue to go off the rails and that more people will see, because this is so much less about Trump than it is about a government that is out of control and that is using its power. These bureaucrats are using their powers, or in some cases elected officials, are using their power to prosecute their political enemies. And that's what we're seeing so clearly with Trump. And the crazier they get, the more obvious it is. And I hope that people rise up against it. You can't have the unaccountable bureaucrats using all of the force and power and resources of government to prosecute their political adversaries.
I mean, if you think about this, you have One Democrat elected official in a huge state, Letitia James, working with this Democrat whack job judge. It's non-jury, right? Even if it was a jury, it wouldn't matter. Then they just arbitrarily come up with this figure. She imposes a, what, $112,000 a day fine for every day that he doesn't pay this the initial sum. And she's bragging about it on Twitter and or Twitter X. This is not... This shouldn't be happening in America. Like, this is the stuff we read about that happens legitimately in banana republics or Marxist style countries, not here. So,
well, we claim to fight about it, right? I mean, we start wars and go into countries and have regime changes based on the very things that are happening right now.
Exactly. And so you compound that with now what's happening in Georgia, the Fannie Willis, we could talk about Judge Scott McAfee, who, of course, punted, as a lot of people expected, on holding accountable Fannie Willis for what she did. Then, of course, we've got what's happening in Florida. We've got the trial postponed in Washington. I mean, regardless of what you really think about Donald Trump, and I mean, we've certainly have our criticisms of him. This is unprecedented.
It is.
Never has this country seen such lawfare, civil and criminal, against not just a former president, but the Republican nominee for president this year. I mean, there's a very good chance, Liz, that Donald Trump could be on trial in Washington, D.C. on Election Day.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? I don't even know how would that even play out? It is unprecedented. I think that that's the best description of it, depending on, I guess, the timeline on how these cases roll, like, work out. But I think that was always the plan, don't you? It was always to, like, muck up the machine so that we couldn't have a regular primary season rematch between Biden and Trump that just went smoothly. They can't just let Trump run on his own, right? And just go out there with his policy positions and his campaigns and compete against Biden, who is on all fronts a disaster, losing support from his traditional cohorts by the hour. Hispanics are abandoning him. Blacks are abandoning him.
College
students don't like him. The Muslims are mad at him. The Jewish people are mad at him. Just the average person that doesn't understand why the McDonald's value menu doesn't start at a dollar anymore, but starts much higher because you can't get
the $5
now. Yeah, now it's like a $5. You know, actually, I went to McDonald's the other day. Kevin likes Ace likes McDonald's, and during near Easter, during I guess Lent, they have the filet of fishes are on sale. So it used to be you could get 2 for $5. Now it's 2 for $6. It's just like Bidenomics. There you go. So people are not happy with the direction of the country, and they're not happy with Joe Biden. So of course he can't run against Trump, where the economy was doing very well and things were great until COVID. That's another issue that was curiously timed. But now this, it's they're going to gum up the machine of an election. They're going to keep him in trial. They're going to keep the headlines. So the headlines are going to be about what's going on with Trump, what he's accused of. They will go unchallenged instead of a normal media cycle during an election where the headlines are about the campaign issues. What are we going to do about the economy? What are we doing about all the wars Biden started? What are we going to do about the fentanyl crisis? What's going on with all the crazy trans stuff? That's not going to be in the headlines. The headlines are always going to be about the latest Trump trial.
There was just a survey that came out I think it was yesterday or today as we're taping Thursday, about, I think for the first time, the United States has dropped out of the happiness index, happiest citizens, for the first time, I think.
Surprised me.
Like the top 20. And the most unhappy, of course, are 30 and under, which is really sad. And we understand why, for a number of reasons, to your point, the woke culture. I'm sure the impact of the lockdowns, which unbelievably we were under lockdown 4 years ago this week, not a good anniversary.
Does it feel like 4 years ago? I mean, it actually feels much more recent. I think everybody's perception of time.
I agree with you. Yep.
Our perception of time has totally changed because of those lockdowns. I can't explain exactly why, but I have excellent recall and I have a really good memory, but I think that something was a year ago, but it was really 4 years ago because it's like a vacuum when the lockdown started. So I'm sure that that's affected the under 30 crowd, not to mention the disgusting constant dopamine feed from these awful social media outlets where kids are constantly jacked into their phones.
They're never in the moment. You know, they don't, there's no social cohesion, right? They're not coming about, you know, they're not, to your point, they're not at the mall. They're not out doing things like kids and teenagers and young people used to do. I mean, I will say my oldest daughter's 23. A lot of her contemporaries who got in the workforce, a lot of them are still working from home remote, especially if they're in big cities, because this is now what young people are used to. They don't want to go back into the office for a lot of reasons. One is they don't want to deal with the crime in these big cities. And two is this is just what they've sort of been programmed to do. So, which seems fine, and there's definitely benefits to it. But the downside is you're not socializing. You're not finding a mate at the office, right? You're not making friends at work, which is in your 20s really how you make friends after you leave college. You know, you've got built-in friends your whole life, and then you get out in the workforce and you become friends with your office mates. And that's just not happening. And there's no social, you know, there's still people are going out, but it's just not to the same degree that it was before the lockdowns.
I think that just is compounded by the fact that this is like the internet generation. So these kids were also heavily invested in social connection through social media as teenagers. They were on Facebook when Facebook was cool for younger people, or Instagram or Snap or TikTok, even as teenagers. So already their skills were lacking in that department. And now just it's compounded by not going into an office, being around people, learning how to navigate different kinds of people, which is what you learn. I mean, it's not just about friendships, which is important, but also how to deal with different kinds of people that you deal with in the work in the workplace. You have difficult bosses, you have crazy coworkers, you have awesome coworkers, things like right. that. These kids have no skills to do that. And so they're unhappy and they're extremely anxious, which is crazy because when you're in your 20s, that should be the greatest, that should be the most free you're ever going to be in your 20s, because the older you get, the more responsibility you have and the more people depend on you, like your kids,
that's right.
your spouse, yeah. things like that. Yes. Or as your career, as you climb up a career ladder, same thing. When you're in your 20s, you're just like living in an apartment with five other people. You're out drinking. Hell, I mean, in our 20s, we would go out, go out all night, come back late, and in 2 hours we would get up and go into an office and do our job.
Oh God,
you know,
don't remind me.
These people are like, I need a personal day. Are you kidding? I mean, the things we were able to do hungover is astonishing.
And let's just say that is a skill. It is a lifelong skill. Learning how to function when you've had too much to drink the night before.
Yes. Or I dare say learning how to drive drunk.
Okay, don't cross the line. Don't cross the line. No, never.
Mm-mm. Don't do that. It's wrong.
But, you know, here's the thing, the challenge for Joe Biden among all of his challenges and the Democrats is you can roll out all the statistics that you want. You can try to head fake the American people that the economy is chugging along and look at the Dow Jones and, you know, look at the stock market and look at prices are coming down. Americans want to be happy. They want to be happy. They want to feel safe. They want to feel like their kids have a good future. Maybe not the same that we had, right? Because everything changes. But Americans want to be happy. And Joe Biden is a miserable, lying, divisive, really destructive president. And it's not just what he's doing here, but what he's promoting around the world. So, and his party is in lockstep with him. I mean, there was another poll that came out. Who are the most miserable people in America? Progressives, especially white women, liberal Democrats, are miserable. But they, for some reason, they get off on being miserable. Okay, fine. But the rest of the country doesn't want to feel that way, right? We want to feel happy, productive, safe, and that our children have a good future. And that's just not the sentiment. So how is Joe Biden all of a sudden, after calling half the country domestic terrorists and locking up and bragging about how much prison time people who protested his election on January 6th are spending in jail? How do you reverse that? You don't. I mean, he's created it, and it's too far gone for him to try to put on, lunch pail Joe, here I am, look at my smile, everything's great.
Well, also, he's not even campaigning on an accurate portrayal of the state, right, of how things are. I mean, he's not admitting the economy's bad. He's just out there not that long ago talking about how inflation is over, right? But if I'm playing $2, two for $6 of filet of fishes at McDonald's, sir, then no, I don't think the economy is in good shape. So they're out there also, there's so much cognitive dissonance with what he's saying that, oh, things are not so bad. Inflation's almost over. And then he's talking about how people aren't getting enough chips in their bag of chips. Well, yes, there's shrinkflation, right? He's saying, in the cereal boxes are lighter and the chips are lighter. And so what's the reason for that, Joe? You know, what is the reason? And I think he wants people to think these companies all of a sudden under his presidency are gouging people. Whereas not even that long ago, probably five years ago, because of COVID wiped the economy, things were much better, much different. People were flourishing. So it's a hard sell. And this is why I think that they don't want Trump and Biden to actually have a real campaign. And I've said repeatedly on this podcast, there's no way they are going to be able to have an honest, campaign season where they're going head to head and that Biden stands on his record and Trump stands on his record when he was president. They just can't have that. There has to be some weird circumstance that somehow intervenes or something that prevents this from happening, because Joe, who I read has special shoes now to keep him from falling.
Yes, he does.
They're Hokas. I guess Hoka makes anti-fall shoes, that he's going to be able to go out and vigorously campaign and support his policy decisions when there's so many fronts where people are unhappy. I mean, also, people are sick of the Ukraine war.
Yes.
They're sick of the Ukraine war. And we're constantly being asked to fork over more money. At the same time, we have a homeless problem and there's homeless camps cropping up all over the place in the public squares.
And squatters just going in people's homes.
Squatters, everything's locked up because people are just stealing everything because the cops don't arrest thieves anymore. And this is happening repeatedly on a regular basis in major metropolitan areas. And people see it. And we're supposed to think, oh, yes, I want 4 more years of this. Who thinks Joe's going to last 4 more years? I mean,
and look, there's nothing wrong with an 80 some odd year old man wearing special shoes to get around so you don't fall. But you shouldn't be president then. You shouldn't be. Look at Trump.
He's just a few years younger.
He's only a few years younger than Biden and he moves around no problem. I mean, my grandfather lived into his early 90s. At 80, you would have thought he was 60. So, he doesn't have the mental capacity to be president,
right,
or
that's
even know who, where he is. And he doesn't have the physical capacity. It's painful to watch that man try to walk around. You're really no matter how much you despise him and what he's doing to the country, you're still gritting your teeth, waiting for him to just brittly fall over.
It's elder abuse.
Yeah. But, and there was an article, was it NBC News? It was one of the major outlets that he's ranting and raving and swearing to his staff because his poll numbers are so bad.
Yeah. That was NBC that he, I guess, got angry, which he usually comes off as angry.
He's an angry man. Let's not pretend that he's not.
He seems very angry, but he got very angry and upset when he found out how he's losing to Trump. And he's losing to Trump, not just at the nationally, because as you know, that doesn't matter. What matters are these battleground states. And he's losing to Trump in every battleground state. He's down in Arizona. He's down in Georgia. I think he's in trouble in Michigan.
He is.
You had 10% of the people voted for not Joe Biden in the Democrat primary, which is a problem since that those margins are quite small in the past in the Biden-Trump and even in the Trump-Hillary, that was a pretty small margin. So in these battleground states, he is in trouble, which means he's really in trouble. In fact, I just saw the cover of Time Magazine, not because I don't read, obviously I don't read Time Magazine, but I saw on Twitter, which was a picture of Joe on a bike and it just said stuck. And even Time Magazine, they're sounding the alarm on the campaign because obviously they are on Team Biden. But where, how to change it? I mean, how can you possibly change it? I don't know how you can make things better. The only thing is they have to hope that they put Donald Trump in prison. And so he can't be president. That's what it seems like they're counting on.
They are. And I think that was really what they had anticipated. I mean, let's keep in mind right now, we should be on week two of his trial in Washington for the events of January 6th, the 4-count indictment by Jack Smith. That trial was supposed to start March 4th. They thought, okay, this trial is going to last 6 to 8 weeks, you know, a week or maybe a week of jury selection. Who knows? And you're going to have a dead ringer conviction. A Democratic jury comes back before a Democratic judge who is going to and will, when she has the chance again, suppress any exculpatory evidence that Donald Trump can show the jury. And she'll rubber stamp whatever DOJ wants because that's what she does. This is Judge Tanya Chutkan. So they thought, you know, they would be looking by the end of April to a guilty conviction. Conviction on all 4 counts for Donald Trump. And then a few months later, summer, as the RNC convention gets underway, sentencing him to years in prison for the convictions of those 4 bogus, super vague charges. So apparently they weren't thinking for looking ahead at this presidential immunity matter. And the reason why the trial is now indefinitely postponed is because Donald Trump's claims that presidents cannot be criminally prosecuted, something that has never been done in American history. That's before the Supreme Court. Oral arguments are April 25th. It could be end of May at the soonest, end of June at the latest, that the Supreme Court would come back. If they do deny his presidential immunity claims, then the trial in Washington, that calendar can restart, which, as we've said, Liz, could potentially put Trump on trial in the nation's capital at the end of October, because Judge Tanya Chutkan and DOJ have said, you know, the political calendar has no impact on when the trial begins. DOJ has said it's out of our hands. We don't have to abide by the 60-day rule. No prosecutions or criminal indictments before a major election. Merrick Garland has said, no, okay, well, it's out of our hands. It's in both judges' hands now, the criminal indictments. And Judge Tanya Chutkan has made clear the political calendar, politics has no role in my courtroom. That's what she said. So anyone, again, disabusing anyone of thinking that how evil these people are and vengeful, they would put him on trial as Americans are headed to the polls.
Let's talk about the one interesting case that I think came out on Monday. The Supreme Court heard arguments on Murty versus Missouri. That's the First Amendment case. And that's really important. The AG of Missouri, I think, brought this case. Is that right? Against
the federal Missouri government. And Louisiana. And then the Attorney General of Missouri at the time.
The AG of Louisiana is now the governor of Louisiana. And the AG of Missouri is now, I believe, a senator. Eric Schmidt?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, he's a good dude. So basically, this case has gone through the system. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed, the district court in Louisiana and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that the Biden White House, the FBI, the CDC, all of the alphabets were actively and through cutouts pressuring or basically dictating to the social media companies what needed to be censored from the internet. The companies like Twitter, we know this from the Twitter files, also Facebook, Instagram. And there's no reason to think all of the companies, LinkedIn, whatever, Snapchat, I don't know, OnlyFans, who knows, were being pressured to ban and censor speech that wasn't approved by the government. Now, the government was claiming and did try to claim that they had good reason for censoring the speech. In other words, vaccine hesitancy, that, you know, they didn't want a growing wave of vaccine hesitancy to take their experimental vaccine, or that it was election disinformation. That's how they cloak their intent, is by saying, well, this is disinformation, which reminds me of that nice New York Times piece over the weekend talking about how Republicans are winning their war against disinformation, as if we're the ones fighting the disinformation and the New York Times isn't the disinformation.
Right.
So anyway, it turns out, we learned from the Twitter files, that all of these agencies were in direct contact with the social media companies and these fake cutouts that are supposed to be these independent agencies and entities that are evaluating and determining what is or isn't disinformation. I think there's one at Stanford. The Aspen Center has one. These little agencies and groups, which, of course, are funded by federal money, I might add, to determine what is disinformation, and then going to Twitter and Facebook and saying, oh, this is false, so you have to censor them. And the most notable case, of course, the most obvious instance of this was the Hunter Biden laptop, where on Twitter, before Elon Musk bought it, Jack and his crew and his trust and safety crew censored that story from being shared, talked about, banned the New York Post for, I think, 2 weeks, where they couldn't get into their account. Facebook prevented people from sharing it, even privately. So these sorts of things were happening across all social media platforms to keep people from tweeting things like, I just got a vaccine and now I have an inflamed heart, or these are the side effects from my vaccines, or I took ivermectin and I recovered really quickly from COVID, anything along those lines, or anyone saying things like, I don't think mail-in voting is secure. These were all things that the government was censoring or pressuring other, or pressuring social media outlets through these fake entities or institutions that appear to have credibility but don't, to remove what they determined was disinformation. So this case was wound up at the Supreme Court. It was argued for on Monday. Some of the I've heard mixed reviews of it. Some people are not optimistic, but some of the things we learned from the case is that the government doesn't want its free speech policed. But like, the government thinks it has free speech rights, which is hilarious because it doesn't. Right. It's not a person. So the government thinks it has free speech rights, and those rights include telling Twitter to take down or censor or shadow ban people who say things that they don't like. They think that the right to free speech on the government is real special. That's a real special claim. They also think that they should be allowed to police speech during the elections, that I guess the threat of election disinformation, which really isn't defined. What is it? What is information, or what opinions are going to be shared on social media that are going to, I don't know, affect somebody's voting rights? I mean, again, these are absolutely absurd things. But I think more importantly and more relevantly, and something that's going to be even more relevant is the future, is this idea that if there is an emergency big enough that they are then allowed to censor people, right? That they just need to declare a public emergency. And that's what they said about COVID, right? That, well, COVID is such an emergency that people no longer have rights. But the reason we have a Bill of Rights is precisely in all cases, including and especially in emergency cases, the government is limited what it can do over the individual. But now we have the federal government and the public health officials arguing that in a case of emergency, people don't have rights anymore. But I think the cherry on top of that whole hearing on Monday was when our I don't know, pity. Well, I don't want to say that because it's
really. All right, let's be careful.
You know what I'm going to say. I'm not going to say it. But yes. Our like charity case, Supreme Court Justice
DEI,
our DEI hire, Ketanji Brown Jackson, was very vocal about very clueless on the First Amendment. She thinks that the government does have the right to censor people when the circumstances merit it. And of course, when, what are the circumstances that merit it? Oh, whatever the government says. So that was a rare glimpse when her slip was showing, as they say. I'm a little worried about Kavanaugh being kind of weak on that.
Yep. Yes.
You know, and I heard some criticism of the plaintiff, a lawyer, not going hard enough and not bringing the best case, and that the DOJ brought a really good case. So,
yeah, I'm looking. Ben Weingarten, who has been following this from the start, and he attended the oral arguments in person this week. He's got a piece up at the Federalist. And he walks through, and I mean, people who were watching it, to your point, were very alarmed at not just, I mean, who could be alarmed at what Ketanji Brown Jackson says, but also comments by Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, who is turning into a real, real problem. And
women, it's always the women.
It's the women's. It's the women's. These women's causing problems. It is, because this is what happened. The four chicks, the little hens, the SCOTUS hens, after the
SCOTUS hens,
SCOTUS hens, the unanimous 9-0 decision to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court removing Trump from the ballot. Nonetheless, Amy Coney Barrett had to write a nasty school marm caveat to the opinion, saying that she didn't like the tone of the opinion. Whoever wrote it, we don't know who wrote it because it was pure per curiam, which means the whole court, but nobody cops to writing it. She didn't like the tone and basically was saying our job right now is to lower the political temperature in the country, not make it worse. No, that's not your
job. That's not what it is, actually.
I know we talked about this. It's not your job. We're not your children. And so I guess she made some comments too, but I don't know this, you know, this speak. So we'll see what happens. But Ben Weingarten, I'm going to look at his piece. I would encourage others to do it, too, because he's covered this really extensively. What they come back with, and this will have an impact, especially
absolutely,
as we're in the 2024 election, because to your point, we know now with the Twitter files that these big tech companies were very closely in cahoots with especially the San Francisco FBI field office, Elvis Chan, to, you know, squelch all of the information about Hunter Biden's laptop. And then after the election, to your point also then about vaccines and really threatening these companies. And at one point, I think Elvis Chan, and I was reporting on it at the time, low-key threatened these companies. Well, either you remove it or we're going to get a subpoena and, you know, claim some sort of made-up imaginary crime, which they can do, to go after them. So I don't know. People have been following it closely and thought this would be sort of a layup, which nothing is with the Supreme Court, are very concerned that they will be on the side of the government.
And it was such a good case to start with, I think. I mean, it was as strong as it could be against what we now know happened and all of the evidence of direct involvement. I just don't know logically how you can say that getting emails or having a secure portal with the intelligence community where you're naming names and telling companies to pull their stuff or fake warning them. I think that was at the Aspen Center. It was the fake warning of the Hunter Biden that there was going to be hack and leak, you know, that had to do with Hunter a little bit before the New York Post ran their story, which they knew that Miranda Devine and the New York Post had gotten the laptop in advance. The feds knew. The FBI had the laptop for a year before they got to the New York Post. A copy of it got to the New York Post. So they conveniently prepared the Aspen Center. I think there was a big meeting with a bunch of these clowns, letting, you know, where the clowns told the social media companies, look, there's going might be a hack and leak and it's Russian disinformation right before the New York Post. I don't know how something like that can happen. And then you can say that the government isn't involved in regulating free speech. You know, I don't know. Just like I don't know how somebody can't go on to Twitter and say, I don't like the lockdown. I think it's bad for people. It's bad for children. It's not, kids aren't getting educated. And this remote learning is terrible, that you would get, that the government would tell the companies, the social media, you got to take that down, or you want to shadow ban them, or what was it, like de-elevate them, like kind of hide them, not just shadow banning.
Yeah, they screw with the algorithms. So
yeah, like mess with the algorithm. So as many people didn't see them, even their followers. I mean, if that is not the textbook definition of interfering in free speech, and I think some of these platforms were a little uncomfortable with it, but what are they going to do? The government kind of has a threat over them, because all of a sudden, like what they're doing with Elon now, all of a sudden Elon's getting some investigations, right? The SEC is interested in some of the stuff Elon's doing, and other businesses that he has. So it is threatening. It is threatening to say that we're going to start having some forensic examinations of your business dealings, and there might be some regulatory action held against you. When the government comes and says something like to ask you to do something, you don't really have a choice. So, it'll be very disappointing, because it will be the springboard for unbelievable censorship going forward. If they do not make the right decision.
Yeah, it's really, sort of scary too, but at least we know Twitter, or we know X, Elon Musk is not going to be working with DOJ and the FBI to suppress. They're just going after him at many different angles to make his life miserable and try to shut down his businesses. So at least we have the full facts, the Twitter files and this lawsuit particularly, and the fact that finally, you had Republican attorney generals use their authority to expose this to the American people, hold some of these, if not, you know, accountable in a civil lawsuit, but at least expose what these people have been doing, whether it was the Surgeon General, Jen Psaki, any of these government officials. And, you know, they got a taste of their own medicine, because they had to hire attorneys and they had to fight, you know, subpoenas for testimony. I know Jen Psaki did. And so they, for once, they had lawfare, and this wasn't really lawfare. This is important, right. You know, free speech matters, but the tables were turned a little bit. So I guess for, you know, the outcome, if it's in the government's favor, of course, is very consequential, but at least these frauds, these charlatans had to go through what the regime and DOJ and prosecutors love doing to people on the right.
Yep. All right. Well, we are at our hour.
Wow.
So Julie, are we going to be here next week?
Yes, we will.
We're going to be here next week. Very exciting. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. If you haven't already, subscribe on iTunes or on Spotify, where Joe Rogan has his show. I'm always going to say that.
Yes, you are.
Have a lovely weekend. Go outside, spend time with your family, get off the internet, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to Happy Hour with Julie and Liz. We'll see you next week.